Another year has come and gone. Are you wondering what the future holds? Are you struggling with the decision about love, money, your career, your family? StarPsychics.com, that stars with a Z, has the answers you desire. StarPsychics.com is the best and brightest advisor site on the internet, staffed by top-rated, professional, fully tested, and certified advisors. This is the real deal. At StarPsychics.com, you create your own personal account, and you pick your advisor by reading their extensive bios. Then you decide on a budget that you are comfortable with. Your pathway to a clearer and brighter future is just a few clicks away. No gimmicks, no bait and switch. StarPsychics.com has daily blogs and lots of links to help you develop your own intuition. Log on now. That's StarPsychics.com. Remember, stars with a Z. And here's the best part. They're available 24/7. StarPsychics.com. Remember, stars with a Z. You must be 18 years or older. Your future awaits.
Hello, everybody. This is Natalie, also known as StarsCast. I like to tell people that in case they're just joining us for the first time and they're going to say, well, who is this lady anyways? Well, I've been doing the shows for, 10 years, and I think this is number 259, I think is my episode. We missed some in during the, like holidays or whatever it fell on, my granddaughter's birthday, that kind of stuff. But been doing it a long time, and I really love what I'm doing. Wait till you hear my guest today. For those of you who live in the South, anywhere, or, I mean, it could be anywhere in the United States, there's going to be a place just like this somewhere. I mean, there's tons of them everywhere. And the story he's going to tell is going to be so unique. I can't wait. I've already read the book, so I know all about it. But anyways, I want to remind everybody, the Mystic Living Today is up, mysticlivingtoday.com. It went up on the 1st. You can start sending me, excerpts, poetry, anything really that you want to submit. Make sure that you have an image with it, because I'll write you back and ask for an image that you own. Now, you can't go taking stuff off of Google, because what people don't understand is Google is just a place. It's just a source. It doesn't mean they own the pictures. You have to find out if it's copyright free, and a lot of them are not. So you'll say, oh, I found a picture to go with myself. No. What I use is depositphotos.com, or there's a place called Pexels. You can use them. Now, deposit photos, I have the license over there. So, anything that I get from there, nobody can say anything, oh, you're using my picture. And that's why I do it, because it's safe that way. So you can do that. And the next issue I will be putting up at the end of the month. Okay, so it'll be probably like the 28th, something like that, because it's a short month. And then also StarsWithAZPsychics.com. You just heard that from my friend Kim. She did that radio spot for me on a radio show, actually. They would play it every hour they were playing it for forever. And then, it was exposure. But, I probably did that at the wrong time, because when you do something like that, people have to have something to write down. And I thought, well, maybe if they just remember Stars with a Z, not the channel on DirecTV, maybe they'll look it up that way. But I loved it. I really loved it. They did a show with me, and it was a lot of fun. And, of course, Kim got to be my friend. But anyways, on with the show for today. And everybody knows I love this. I love talking to new people that I'm meeting for the very first time, and so are you. My guest today has written a book called The South Carolina State Hospital, Stories from Bull Street. Now, you can probably think, uh-oh, what is this, a spooky place? Oh, just wait. And I want to welcome my guest, William Buckhite. Buckhite, right? Is that right?
That is correct. How you doing, Natalie?
Buckhite. Yay! How are you tonight, William? Good? Or today, I should say. Good, right?
Doing fantastic. I appreciate it. And thank you for having me, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'm telling them, we were talking a little bit about places that were built in the 1800s, so, late 1800s. And they started off to have this one was 1821. They started off on a good note.
Correct.
But then things changed, and we want to hear all about it. But I want to talk a little bit about you too. Okay, have writing in your background. You're a newspaper journalist. It was your father, right?
There
was a a newspaper person? Is he still doing that?
No. My father passed away long ago, actually, but he did work in newspapers for all of his life. And his father, my grandfather, actually, was the publisher of the Spartanburg Herald Journal back in the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
The Spartanburg Herald Journal, yeah. So my dad was an editor for that paper and a business manager. And my family owned a few daily newspapers all across the Southeast. And that's how I got into writing. I went to school and I studied English. I went to a liberal arts college where they didn't really have journalism as a major. And then I went to USC, Columbia, and I studied American literature. And then I went immediately and started working in journalism. My first day of work was September 10th, 2001. So my second day is September 11th, and that's when all hell broke loose.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a lot to write about, right? Did you do a lot? I mean, that must have been – when I think about that day, I think about all these people that had to write about what occurred and their view of it and what they saw, what they didn't see. That must have been – that had to have been tremendous for anybody writing at that time, right?
Oh, it was. It was. I mean, there were so many different stories, everything from – I remember going to the Greenville-Spartanburg airport and interviewing people coming off planes and seeing how scared and apprehensive they were. And then I remember trying to go to Westgate Mall to interview people, and they closed the mall. And then eventually down the line, I interviewed – I had a former art teacher who was working for the Red Cross, and he was up at Ground Zero working day after day. And then – later on, I interviewed a woman. She actually turned out to be a girlfriend of mine who was living up in Manhattan when September 11th happened. Told me a whole different element. But yeah, that was my second full day of work, and it's one I'll never forget. That's for sure.
No, and I think everybody remembers where they were. What was I doing? Oh, I know. We were packing the house because we were getting ready to move in October. We had sold my house, our house, and a business, not a big business, but we sold that. And I remember my office, I could see directly down the hall, and I could see the TV. And I saw this, and I thought, I don't even know what I thought. I went down the hall, it was a short little hall, and I thought, what in the world has happened? You know, it was, nobody will ever
surreal.
Forget that.
Yeah.
It's horrific. It's horrific. Now, okay, so let's move ahead now.
Sure.
So from there, what did you do?
Okay, so I worked as a journalist for newspapers for the better part of 20 years, actually. And I wrote about a host of things. I had a column I wrote. I wrote sports stories. I wrote a lot of book, movie, and concert reviews. I wrote a whole host of things, but mainly the subjects that I cared most about and that meant the most to me were doing feature stories about people who live kind of on the fringes of society, whether it be poor or that kind of thing. You know, America and the world, for that matter, we still stigmatize a lot of these people. And I want to bring it's been kind of my lifelong goal to bring some of these stories out and kind of give these people, you know, to humanize them to some degree. And
exactly.
So,
and for everybody else to realize what really went on, you know. So now tell me, why did you write about the hospital in South Carolina? I mean, I know you're from, you're homegrown,
sure.
But I mean, why? I mean, there are other places that you could have written about. But, of course, this is in the state, you know, and I didn't even know until I read your book where I got it in the mail that it existed. I mean, I'm not from here, that's why. Now, in Detroit, I can tell you a lot of horror stories, but this book, everybody really should read it. Again, it's South Carolina State Hospital, Stories from Bull Street. Now, the reason it's Bull Street, it sits on Bull Street, correct?
Yes, and what I've found, what I've discovered over the years researching this book and writing this book is, first of all, every state has at least one public mental hospital, one state hospital. Some of the bigger states have two state hospitals, but every state has at least one.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I got into the way I got into writing the book was, I was in a bookstore one day and I found a photo book called Asylum by a photographer named Christopher Payne. And in it, he had gone through to all these state hospitals all across America, and he had taken photos of the inside, the interiors and the exteriors. And what it did was it kind of photographically gave a history of mental health treatment over the years. I was blown away by the book. It just so happened I was getting into photography at the time. This is around 2010. And so I thought the coolest thing in the world would be to try to go to the state hospital in Columbia and try to do the same thing that he had done, and that was, you know, to photograph the interiors and the exteriors of the state hospital in Columbia.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I have questions. Go ahead.
Well, I don't want to turn it into a soliloquy here. I don't want to go into, you know, make it sound like a long monologue. So go ahead with your question.
Well, so okay, my first thought is, did they let you on the grounds to take pictures?
Okay, that's a very good question. Okay, they did allow me on the grounds to take pictures. I had to get written consent from the Department of Mental Health.
Okay.
Which I was able to do because I worked in the media, okay? And there was a woman working for the Department of Mental Health that was real friendly and helped me out a whole lot. Now, once I was on the campus, I would take some pictures from the exteriors, and then I would kind of, I'll be honest with you, kind of illegally
sneak in. Oh, no, I would have done the same thing.
yeah, I'll be honest with you. Yeah. Yeah, I would sneak in about any building, you know, that had an open window or door or
that's an invitation
any place
to me.
I
Let's go.
It was, and I loved it. And like I said, I was just getting into photography. I wasn't very good at all to begin with, and it's difficult circumstances in those hospitals because they're almost pitch black inside. So it's tough. It's low light shooting conditions, and I just kind of improved as I went. But I remember the first day I ever went and did that. It was on Super Bowl Sunday, I believe, of 2010 or 11.
So it was pretty dark, and probably when you went in, right?
It was very dark.
Or you started out light, and then it gets dark earlier. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It was dark. It was cold. It was musty, and I was immediately hooked. And I remember I snapped a few photos, and then I was afraid of getting busted by the police. So I got out of there, but I returned almost at least a couple times a month for the next year and a half, 2 years. And the more photographs I took, the more I researched the hospital, and I began to find all of these artifacts in there. I found patient records. I found yearbooks. I found journals. I found get well cards.
Inside the hospital?
Inside the hospital, yes. to be honest with you, Natalie, it was almost like a storm or some disaster was coming, and everybody just left and left everything as it was in some of these buildings. It was amazing.
So you got so hooked on this. I mean, I would have too. So you took pictures of probably everything that you could take pictures of, and then just let the chips fall where they may, whatever's good and whatever's not good. Okay, so you probably got this sense of this feeling. Did you get a feeling in there? You know what I do. So, I mean, because I'm very spiritual.
Mm-hmm, I do.
Did you get a feeling of, like, something looking out for you, looking at you, over you? I mean, sometimes when you go, and this is if you're clairaudient, if you're clairsentient, you can smell. If you're, uh-huh. you know, if you're anything in the clairs, you can walk into something and something is going to affect you. It does when I go to Savannah, because Savannah is probably one of the most places where you could encounter a ghost. It's very haunted. The whole city is. And I did, and my granddaughter said, come over here, Grandma, I get this feeling. And so we saw this alley. I'm sure you got that feeling, didn't you? And I went down it, and I got the chills because I knew there was some entity around me. I couldn't see it with my eyes, but I could feel it. So, so did you get any of that? I'm so curious.
Oh, yes. Oh, I got plenty of that. I was on edge almost every time I was in there. You know, all of your senses are incredibly sharp. The smell, yeah, I got a sense of, you know, some of the patients and staff that had been there over the years. Some of these buildings are over 100 years old, and it was strange. I got a feeling that I was being watched a lot, actually.
How many buildings were on this campus, as you called it? I mean, how many, was there a big main building or in smaller places where they would be housed? Or, I mean, I read the book, but I want the listeners to know what this facility was like. It was pretty big, wasn't it?
Oh yeah. It was very big. It was about 170 acres and had tons of buildings all over it. You know, some people think of state hospitals, they think of like one castle-like structure. But usually state hospitals had many, many different buildings where they would, you know, seclude the patients. And the state hospital in South Carolina, the first building was called the Mills Building, and it was built prior to the Civil War and opened in 1821. And then it wasn't enough room, and then they built a giant Kirkbride building called the Babcock Building, and it's the biggest there, and it's the scariest looking, and it's the most castle-like looking. And
I saw all the pictures. I even went online a little bit because I was so nosy. And I mean, I knew you would tell me, but I was just so curious, you know. I'm always fascinated with buildings that are left, but this one in particular. Now, it started off okay, right? I mean, you know, to have people come in and be treated, and it wasn't overpopulated. But then what happened? How did this get to be so bad?
That's a very good question. I think more and more patients started pouring into the hospital after World War II and after the Korean War, and basically they just had way too many patients and not enough staff to work there. And this happened all across America. It was a nationwide problem. So it was a tough job working there because it was dangerous. You know, a lot of the staff were hurt by patients. They took a lot of sacrifices to work there. They could have made a lot more money working in normal hospitals.
Right.
And way back when, especially in the early 60s and the 50s and all of that, it was before the advent of psychotropic drugs. So you didn't have all these shots like Thorazine and Haldol
to calm them down, or memory enhancers and all this kind of stuff. You're right.
The patient. Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So all you had back then were, you know, you had restraints, you had the straight jackets, you had, you know, they would literally chain patients to beds. They would give
maybe shock treatments. Did they do shock treatments there? Probably they did.
They did a ton of electroshock therapy there.
Yeah.
Tons. Some patients they would give it to you every month. I mean, and we're talking hundreds of treatments over the years, and they didn't realize it at the time. The problem was they didn't know some of these things they were doing were bad at the time. But even when you're talking about lobotomies in the 1940s and 50s, they didn't know for a fact it was damaging or destructive at the time. Well, the same with electroshock therapy. They thought it was the best thing that they could do for patients at the time. They didn't realize that it would completely erase their memories.
Erase everything.
Which it ended up.
Yeah.
But I will tell you this, Natalie. ECT, or electroconvulsive therapy, is still actually practiced today. And for a lot of people who, you know, for it's the last case, it's like a last-ditch treatment for incredibly depressed people. It's the only thing that works. The difference is today they give a lot less voltage and they sedate patients beforehand. Back then they gave tons of voltage and they didn't sedate the patient. So it came across as a very, primitive and cruel procedure.
And I'm sure a lot of people died from it, right?
From electroshock therapy?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. I know there were some that died from lobotomies, for sure.
Now, did they do that in this hospital? Lobotomies in the...
That's a good question, and I've asked a lot of people over the years, and most people deny that it ever took place in the state in the South Carolina State Hospital. But there's one nurse I spoke to by the name of Linda McLam, and she told me of one troubled patient who got in some trouble, and the next day she came into the hospital. She was a nurse. Miss McLam was a nurse, and she came into the hospital, and that patient had two black eyes. So it was pretty clear.
I read that in the book, yes.
She had been lobotomized
so she knew the night before.
Right, exactly. And there's another nurse in the book whose mother worked in the state hospital, and the mother had records of all the patients, and she'd seen lobotomies take place at the hospital too. Well, at least she saw some of the patients, end up with lobotomies. Now, whether they went off site or not is a different story. But
yeah.
I think it's certain that some of the patients did receive lobotomies there, you know, in the middle 20th century.
So, do you think, William, it was the fact that it got overcrowded, that it got so bad for the patients as a whole? Because of staff, I mean, so if they had somebody that was acting up, I mean, they had to take great care and try to keep them, you know, in a chair or something. So is that how the trend started? I mean, how do you go from a hospital that's taking care of people that have disorders because they were in the war or whatever, okay, they come home, they have, post-traumatic stress or whatever.
Right.
How do you go from that to something so severe?
I think it was
people in charge? They just got tired of it? I don't know. I just, it amazes me because, man, if you and I were there then, this would not happen.
I know.
But, of course, now we've got to think about this. People, it's a state hospital. So is it funded by, it was funded by the state?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up. So it was a state hospital. It was publicly funded. So most of the people who actually, had some money would, they could send their loved ones off to a private hospital. So the state hospitals ended up with clientele in general. And what happened was they would go to the state hospital, and it was hard to keep staff there. The turnover was very high. The nurses didn't want to work there. And I've talked to people who worked in wards where they didn't even see a doctor for months at a time. So they had a hard time.
So they just put them in a room, sedated them or whatever, and left them there.
Yes.
The doctors.
Yes. What they would do is they would come in. They would check in the hospital. They would get assessed in a building called the Williams Building, and then they would determine what was wrong with the patient, which actually back then there were only a few diagnoses. There was depression, there was manic depression, and schizophrenia. And then they would put them in a particular building where there were other patients similar to that.
Went to hell in a handbag, pardon my expression, but because all these people kept, they didn't know what to do with them. And I would imagine
they didn't. There were just way too many patients, not enough staff, but especially in the early 60s and before then, there weren't enough drugs either. So you put all those things together, and you had a lot of pandemonium going on, and you can compile all that with the integration that happened in the around 1966, 1967,
right?
Where they mixed the blacks and the whites together, and you just had utter pandemonium.
You had other issues that you had to deal with.
Yeah, because for a long time, the African American patients were sent to another state hospital that was called Palmetto Hospital, that was also in Columbia, and the white patients were sent to Bull Street. The reason it's called Bull Street, and I meant to say this earlier, is about everywhere you go in America, they refer to their own. Each state refers to its state hospital usually where it is location wise. So it just so happens the South Carolina State Hospital is right at the corner of Elmwood Street and Bull Street in Columbia. So everybody referred to the hospital as Bull Street, just like in Milledgeville, Georgia, their central state hospital. But everybody refers to that as Milledgeville just because it's in Milledgeville, Georgia.
So the whole thing was closed down what year? I mean, totally empty. And why did it empty? I mean, did it because the funds ran out? How did it completely close? And was it a slow process? What happened?
Good question. And it closed gradually over the course of several decades. Basically, there was a movement that swept the nation called the deinstitutionalization movement. And what happened was there were several things that started giving state hospitals a bad reputation, whether it was John F. Kennedy's sister Rosemary getting the lobotomy.
Yes.
Then we had which was a horrible thing that everybody saw. Then we had Ken Kesey wrote the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in the early 1960s.
Right.
Which was made into a fantastic movie, really, with Jack Nicholson in the mid 70s. So you had all of these cultural movements and films, literature, all these things that kind of demonized the state hospital system. So America kind of turned on it, and everybody thought that it would be easier and more humanitarian to start emptying out the state hospitals and putting the mentally ill in what they called community systems of care is what they called it, which sounded good. Basically, what that meant was they would send mentally ill people. They would keep them in the towns that they're originally from, and they would care for them. And they just wouldn't be locked up. They wouldn't be confined or anything. It sounded good in theory. It sounded great in theory, but the problem was all the funds dried up. In the late 70s, you know, we had a recession that was brought about by the oil crisis, and a lot of the funds dried up for Department of Mental Health care. And once that happened,
all over the United States, you know.
Yeah. And there was nobody to watch over these patients. There was nobody there to make sure they took their medicine. There was nobody there to make sure they had adequate living facilities, to make sure they had food. And as a result, a lot of these mental patients, they couldn't take care of themselves. So they ended up either in homeless or in jails or hospitals, just trying to stay warm. And you see that today, too.
I had a license to do hair, and I worked in a nursing home for 6 years, mm-hmm. and I did their
God
hair.
Bless you. Right.
Yeah, I get like $4 to do their hair or something like that. I did it a long time. Well, you get to know the patients, and this is from the floor talking. You know, I was on the floor with them, and I got to know the nurses. I mean, I knew who was really good and who wasn't. And I would stand out. I had my own room, right? I'd stand out in the hall. When I first got there, everybody, all the patients were there. They were so happy to see me. They'd be lying down the hall to get their hair done. It was wonderful.
Absolutely.
I mean, I loved it.
Yeah,
I really, really did. I had some that were, you know, a little bit, they were always good to me. I mean, I didn't get the nasty ones. I had one that was really demonstrative with everybody else except for me. And they figured it out that because I was small, 5'2", she didn't want to hurt me. She just liked me. So that was okay. But I would watch these nurses, and I would really watch them. And it was like I was the guard dog, I guess. I don't know. Because I wanted to make sure, if you're in my eyes view, that you were doing your job. Isn't that awful? In between, you know, lunch hour, I didn't have any patients to come in to get their hair done. There was a period of like an hour. I'd walk that whole place. I would walk that whole place because I could. I went into the dining room. I went into the room where they had, you know, crafts, their little movie room and all that. Because, you know, there was an instinct that I had. I wanted to make sure nobody was being abused. And I was...
Good for you.
Well, you know, it was just instinctive, William. It wasn't anybody asked me to do it. Nobody said, well, you know what these homes are like. But I did it because I wasn't dying to catch somebody doing something. I just wanted them to know, when she's around, we better toe the line here. Because you didn't know what happened. You just never knew after you left. And while I was there, I never saw anything. They were short-staffed also, like in the dining room. You know, the patients would be clanging their utensils. It was a nice time for me for 6 years, actually, that I didn't have to see anything. I would have reported it. Oh, you bet your life. I would have walked out of there and called somebody.
That's right.
Yeah, I would never have allowed anything to happen.
Good for you, and good for you for monitoring the situation because, everybody knows that there is neglect and sometimes abuse.
My mother-in-law ended up going to that very same facility that I had worked in. They knew me because I had worked there. There were some of the same nurses are still there. I mean, they were my friends. And there was just an unspoken word. Uh-oh.
Right.
Because
exactly.
I just would have told on him. I would have went right into the whatever his name was. He was a man who owned a bunch of them, and I wasn't impressed with him because I think he was just in it for the money. He didn't really care. But most of the nurses were pretty good. I have to tell you, they were pretty good. But this was you know, not in the 50s, of course, and probably I'm thinking, William, that a lot of people that worked there, I mean, because they really couldn't do anything about anything. You know what I'm saying? I mean, even if you saw neglect or you saw something, if you couldn't rescue that patient, or who would you go to say, well, you know, look at this. This is a mess because they'd lose their job.
Exactly. And that happened. You know, there's a few chapters in my book, stories where the nurses actually either saw neglect or saw abuse, and they would report it to the administration. And a lot of times, it would just get, you know, completely dismissed. And so it was very frustrating for the nurses who worked there and were doing their job and really cared about the patients, because not everybody who worked there did. And you had a lot of nurses' aides, and some of them cared about the patients, some of them didn't. You know, you had all kinds of abuse and neglect, but what it comes down to is these patients, you know, these patients have to have somebody advocating for them because they're mentally ill.
Exactly.
If these patients, just like in a nursing home, if the client's family, you know, isn't always checking in on them and making sure everything's okay, you know, anything can happen to them. And that's what you had at the state hospital, because a lot of the patients' families would just drop them off there.
I was going to say dump them.
One
the term is dump them
and never return. Yeah,
right.
Dump them
right
there and never return.
I shouldn't
so
say that. That's awful,
to look
but yeah.
For them. Yeah, so there wasn't anybody to look out for them. So a lot of staff and other patients and could get away with whatever. Now, that being said, the ones featured in my book, the staff featured in my book, they were all very caring souls who really looked after the patients and loved the patients. The thing about the state hospital is, if you didn't love the patients, you weren't going to make it long there, because it was such a rough job and such a dangerous job, and they had to put up with a lot of things. So, you know, in order to stay there a long time, you usually had to care about the patients. And for a lot of these patients, these members of the staff, especially the nurses and the nurses' aides, were the only family they knew. There's a lot of heartwarming stories in the book as well. For instance, there's one nurse's aide named Wilhelmina Rivers, and in the old days, staff could actually take patients off campus, and she took a patient off campus on Christmas Day and took her home for Christmas dinner, gave her a Christmas gift, and then returned her to the hospital. But that's how much she loved that particular patient.
I can relate to all of that. They loved me. I mean, you know, they would go into the the owner in his, and knock on the door. When is she going to be here? When is she going to be here? Because I hovered over them. I took really good care of them. Even I had my son come in with me, like if it was a break he had off, you know, from school. He would come in and we'd go get the patient together sometimes, because sometimes the nurses didn't bring him down or for whatever reason, lazy or whatever. I went and got him.
Oh, yeah.
And then he'd wheel him down. Well, they got to know him. Oh, he's so cute. Where's your son? I mean, they had a time in there, and it makes me feel good, that they were really taken care of to look pretty. Some of them couldn't even sit up in their chair. I managed with them, William. I don't even know how I did it. But I did it, and the only reason I left there was, I'll tell you what happened. Well, a couple of my patients passed away, my long-time ones that I was doing for like 5 years, right?
Uh-huh.
And so then I lost my parents less than 5 months apart of each other. Well, my mother passed away in January, and I was still working there. I saw the place in a different light. I don't know what happened to me. And then my dad, of course, died in July, beginning of July, and that's all I needed was that. And I, you know, I just decided that I did my part. I was there. And
absolutely. And you did more than that.
And I'm forever grateful that I was guided there, because you have no idea, unless you work in a place like that, what it's like. These people know. They had worse situations. I didn't have any bad situations at all. I didn't have anybody try to hurt me. They were just really calm. They weren't overly sedated because they had to sit up. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And some of them, I even learned how to understand. I learned how to understand them. You know, I could understand what they were saying to me, understand what they were saying to me when they wanted something. And they really were hard to understand. They didn't really talk really good. My son would say to me, Mom, I don't know how you do this. How do you do this? I said,
no.
I don't know. But I've always taken care of. That's what I've always done. And I wanted to be a doctor. And first I wanted to be a nurse. And you can see why. And then I wanted to be a doctor. All the doctors, when I'm in a hospital, this is no joke, I feel at home. Because I think I missed my calling in a way, maybe next time around, but I think I did. but, you know, sometimes, William, you can care too much, and then it takes over you, and then you go home with it,
it can traumatize you, sure.
Oh, it does, but I didn't have any of that. I mean, I'd go down and see the patients, you know, if it wasn't this lady, her name was Ellen, if it wasn't her week to get her hair done, I'd go and see her. She was just always so happy. And, you know, sometimes they'd give me little tips, like I get 50 cents or a quarter.
Or
they put it in my pocket. You know, I wore a white uniform, and they put it in my pocket. And I hear from the families. They just love seeing you, and you make them so happy. And it made me happy, you know, and I never regretted that time. I never regretted it. Just like some of the nurses that you have talked to, the people that were there, you have to have a calling for that. You cannot be. You cannot do it and say, "Oh, well, this is going to be easy." No, no. There has to be something about you that you want to take care of. And
you're absolutely right. You couldn't have hit the nail any better. And did you do that up in Michigan, or did you do it in South Carolina?
In Michigan, I did it in Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
and
it does take a special calling, and I'm sure that was difficult. And you have to be able to compartmentalize.
And you leave it home.
That would be the hardest part.
Right. Leave it home. You know, I wouldn't take it back with me. I didn't live very far from this place either. And there was another one. I didn't go to the other one. They had a hairdresser there. But I got the job there because a nurse worked there, and I did her hair. She said, "You should apply over there. They need somebody." And so I got it right away.
And how did it rank as far as quality goes?
Pretty good. It was good while I was there.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened after I left.
You see a bad
because
brain.
See what happens is a lot of the nurses leave. They didn't have a doctor all the time there. They only had the nurses. So you had to depend upon the registered nurses who could give medication. And there were LPNs there. And I kept thinking to myself, if you're an LPN, why don't you just go be a registered nurse? I mean, you can do so much more. You know what I'm saying?
I know. But
sometimes it's money. Sometimes they don't think they're smart enough. Oh, you are. You know?
It can be any number of things. You're right.
This was a nice place, pretty decent. I didn't see anything bad when I was there. I mean, they were just lucky I didn't see anything bad. I haven't shut down in a heartbeat. And I was the same. I had the same sharpness to me as I did then as I do now. I would not have tolerated anything.
Exactly.
And
you're a very intuitive person.
Very,
so
and so, you know, I could tell when they would come in if they were upset. You just got to know them. They were like your friends. That's no joke. They were like your friends. You really cared about them. I looked forward to see. And then, like I said, a couple of mine passed away, and that was hard on me because I had seen them 5 years, the whole 5 years. I was there 6 years. So
I'm sure.
It was like, this was a weekly thing. I mean, I saw them all the time, and I learned one lady could really talk well. She was just kind of crippled up, and she was in a wheelchair. But her family came to visit, and I asked, who comes to visit who? I mean, I was just the nosiest thing that there was. But it was just something that I felt I had to do, William. I had to go and seek out the corners of that place because I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I was sent there like a little angel of the light to just oversee and keep them on their toes, because I did. But I didn't see anything. I really watched the nurses for being rough. And then they had AIDS, like you said. They all had AIDS. And those were the ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of those. And those are the ones who have the most contact with the patients, you know.
Right, and some of them were a little rough.
Yes.
I watched that in this one area that I would go to where they could do anything. They could watch TV or, you know, they'd have to be wheeled in and wheeled out. And I mean, most of them were in wheelchairs.
Like
some of them could walk. Mm-hmm. But I watched that. I wanted to make sure. I almost have this sense that I told somebody, not when she was lifting this lady, but she was really small. It wasn't one of mine. And, you know, I said to her, you know, you could be a little kinder. I said, she depends upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I didn't realize it. I don't think she ever did it again because she knew when I was there, oh, my God. I'm going to get the wrath.
Good for you for intervening, right.
But, you know, that was just something that I felt I had to do. And, you know, so they fired me. So what? They weren't going to fire me.
No, of course not. Those women loved you. I'm sure they loved seeing you. And I bet you knew the names to about all of them, too.
I did.
And
there were
see,
even
I,
some men. And, you know, at that time,
right.
men were going to barbers. The barber quit. They had a barber that would come in, but he left. And so somebody said to me, why don't you cut the men's hair? And I started cutting men's hair. But then, you know, you weren't trained to do that. I figured it out. It wasn't hard. I could do it.
Oh,
just
sure
put me in there,
know.
And I'll figure it out, and I'll do it my own. And it came out; it turned out really good. It really worked for me but I was busy nonstop, except for the time when they went to the lunchroom. You know,
yeah.
I had some time that I could just kind of gather myself and clean up the room a little bit, and you know, for the next batch that was coming in. Sometimes they just wheel themselves down because they wanted to see me.
Oh, I'm sure, because you gave off such a positive vibe, and
I did.
People in those kind of places, yeah, they're so happy to see strangers, and they're so happy
to
see
anybody. Well, you have to be in a place like that to understand what it's really like. And I wasn't in an insane asylum. I was not in a mental hospital. I was just in a nursing home.
Of course not. Right.
You know, I would have been good at this hospital probably, but I probably would have got fired.
Well, in the old days, you know, they actually had a whole geriatric section of the state hospital. And I spoke to one woman, another nurse. It used to be where every prospective nurse in the state of South Carolina, if you were in nursing school, you had to do a psych rotation of 3 months. And if you lived anywhere near Columbia or east of Columbia, you would have to do it at the state hospital, and they would, and you know, the nurses would even live on the grounds, in the Mills building, which was the first building, the first structure put up when the hospital opened. But, you know, obviously it was traumatic for a lot of them. And, I talked to one nurse whose roommate had a nervous breakdown within a week, just because she was so shocked by the poor treatment that the elderly were getting at the hospital. She actually had a nervous breakdown and had to be hospitalized.
Wow.
So those nurses, and you're talking 20-year-old, you know, 20, 21-year-old women.
Right,
and,
just got out of nursing school.
Yeah,
or not out yet. Yeah, that they had to do their 3 months. Yeah, that could be traumatizing. Yeah.
Exactly. They're seeing all kinds of. They're seeing abuse. They're seeing neglect. They're seeing, you know, a lot of scary stuff that they had no idea was even out there. So, I can't imagine seeing that on a daily basis. And even stranger to me is how, in the old days, well, even up through the 70s. They used to take class high school trips, like field day trips, up to the state hospital and to the maximum security prison in Columbia. And that would be a one-day trip. It shocked and horrified a lot of the kids, as you could imagine. We're talking about, you know, 12, 13-year-old children. You know, they're just walking around the hospital seeing all of this. And it has an effect on them even to this day. I get comments about how awful and how traumatic that was.
Well, you know, so the hospital, it kind of dwindled down to not very many patients. But what was there some kind of factor that actually the state decided to close it? Was it lack of funding or what happened? Do you know what happened?
I do. It was a culmination of several things. First of all, you had the deinstitutionalization movement, where basically people started to see state hospitals as cruel, you know, dehumanizing structures, and you know that weren't curing the patients. Second of all, and probably most importantly, you had the advent of psychotropic medication. You had Thorazine, you had Haldol, and then you had all these other mental drugs that have since come out, everything from lithium to the antidepressants and all of those things came out. So it made the patients more manageable, and you know, with some of these patients, the right medicine was all they needed, and they could take care of themselves. So you had the advent of medication, and you just you had a movement during the Reagan administration, especially towards community-based systems of care. And so you had these three things going on. So they started emptying the state hospitals, and they emptied them, you know, bit by bit, starting in the 80s. So whereas there were about 6,600 patients in 1961 at the Bull Street campus, by the 1980s there was only about 700, and it was only like the most mentally ill of a mentally ill who were kept there. Everybody else was, you know, everybody else they attempted to treat at the community level.
So somebody made the decision, though, to close this place. Somebody went.
Yep.
Somebody did their research. Somebody said, you know, this is in disrepair anyhow, and we have nobody there. So did they move the last patient someplace else? Or, I mean, see, that makes me wonder about things in a place like that, you know? Now, another question before I forget is, were you disappointed that you couldn't see some things and take pictures of some things, or did you see everything you wanted?
No, I didn't get in every building I wanted to. I wasn't able to get in the church. There's a church there called the Church of Hope, actually. And it's called the Chapel of Hope. And I wasn't able to get in there. I wasn't able to get in some of the cottages, but most of the major buildings I was able to get into.
Why couldn't you get into the other ones? Why didn't they want you in them?
They were locked up. They don't let anybody in any of these buildings because of a safety standpoint.
Yeah.
They don't want people getting hurt in there. And
could you look
actually,
in the windows? I mean, I know you looked in the windows.
I did everything I could.
I'd be dragging you along. Come on, William, we got to go peek in this window. We can't get in. It's not going to stop us from looking.
I did everything within my power to try to get in those, you know.
Awesome.
I sure did. But not a whole lot went on in the cottages anyway. That's basically where they were just. Some of the patients were kept and they slept. The most interesting buildings to me were the back wards. There's four back wards on Bull Street, and they were maximum security buildings, and they were mainly for people who had committed crimes. They were for criminals, including one of the buildings, the Cooper Building, was a forensics ward. So it was full of patients who had been deemed not guilty by reason of insanity.
Yeah.
And it looked just like a little prison. It had, you know, it had 20-foot high fences around it. It had surveillance cameras everywhere. And that was the building I found most interesting. And luckily, I was able to get into all of those maximum security buildings. And that's where I found
Did somebody have to go in with you when you went there?
Oh, no. Keep in mind, this wasn't legal going in. So I kept to myself, and I never brought anything with me because the place was constantly was under constant surveillance by, they had public safety officers that would just drive around all the time.
Yeah.
Looking for people like me who are trying to.
But you have permission to go there anyways, right?
I had permission to go to the campus and photograph the exteriors. As long as I stayed outside of the buildings, everything was cool.
Oh gosh, that's such a temptation.
I did not have permission to go inside any of them, and that was mainly for my own safety. There was one, the biggest building on the campus is called the Babcock Building. And I was on the third floor of that building one day, and my whole left leg went through the floor. And I could have fallen through the floor, and who knows how long I would have fallen. I probably would have died, but it was because of all the water damage that had happened over the years. And
yeah.
That place was, I mean, you're talking about a place that's almost 200 years old. So they're trying to, you know, a lot of it's trying to protect you from yourself. When it comes to not allowing people inside a lot of those buildings.
But now, you've got a picture of the hospital.
Go ahead.
It's this big tower. Now, what building is that? What? It's a big, huge, like a, looks like a cathedral top. I mean, it's at the cover of,
yeah,
on the cover of your book.
Yes. That's a cupola, actually, is what they call it. And that is the Babcock building. And that was
okay.
That was the biggest building on the campus. It was, it was drawn to the parameters. There's a famous architect in England by the name of Thomas Kirkbride, and Thomas Kirkbride designed the modern state hospital structure. And basically, it would be like it would consist of an administration section in the middle, and then it would branch out into wings. And they would have the men on one side of the building and the women on the other side, and it would kind of branch out like a bat's wings. And the further away you got from the administration part of the building, the center, the sicker the patients got. And so the Babcock building, you wouldn't believe what they're doing with it now. They're actually converting it into luxury townhouses.
You're kidding.
Because No, it's historically
protected.
Well,
it's kind of like Savannah. You know, there's a hospital right in downtown Savannah. They converted it. Now they use it. Well, my granddaughter's going to go to college there. They've converted a lot of those buildings into classrooms, and they really do a great job with them. But this is history. I'm looking at, you know, some of these pictures. You actually got in to take these pictures?
I did, yeah. That's how it all started.
Stretcher, and you got to get this book, people. I mean, this seclusion room, oh, my God.
Seclusion rooms, yeah, all kinds of, yeah. You see the Ponzi gloves, you see the restraint keys, the old piano. One time I was sneaking around there, and I found a People magazine with baby Jessica on the cover. You remember her?
I see that.
So I think that was from 1986, but it had been that long since somebody had been in that part of the building, which is something else. Yeah.
Wow.
But the thing that initially I didn't even start out wanting to write a book about it. I didn't even start out wanting to write articles about it for the newspaper. I really just wanted to take pictures, do a photo book, and kind of keep it to myself. But the more I found and the more I discovered in the place, including the patient files and slides and even audio cassettes and that kind of thing, the more I found, the more I wanted to know. And that's when I started interviewing people who worked there. And then it became a news series in the newspaper. And then once I got up to 20 stories, I submitted it as a book, and that's when it got published. And originally, it was just supposed to be a photography project.
Oh, but how could you stop there? You couldn't.
Oh, I couldn't. I was obsessed with it. I became obsessed. You can ask my family. I'd go to Columbia about every 2 weeks, and sometimes I would go in these buildings. I'd spend sometimes 7-8 hours there. One time I even got lost in there.
I can see you out the window. Help!
Another wild.
They should do a movie about this.
I actually had to go back and look at the images on my camera to kind of trace my way back to where I had come in that building. And it was almost dark by then. I was freaking out. I never went into those buildings at night or in the cover of darkness because I am superstitious. I do believe in ghosts, and I did not want to push my luck.
Well, you know, you're going to hear what I say at the end of the show, and you're going to understand. But I knew this talk today would be awesome. I just knew it. I read this book, and I thought, oh, my God, I have so many questions.
Oh, I know, and there's so much we haven't even been able to get to or anything like that. But I could talk about it for you know, until my voice gave out. I,
gets raspy, like mine.
I love talking about it. And it's, you know, the book, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, you know, it covers, you have a lot of horror, you have a lot of redemption, you have a lot of love in there, you have everything. But the one thing
it's an honest book, though, honest and true from your eyes that you saw.
Right.
Now, when was the last time you were there?
I drove around there probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago, early part of the summer. And
so now
really
the big place, are they doing, that's what's being into apartments, the big one? I mean,
yes, the Babcock building, there's two buildings over there that are historically protected, which means you can't tear them down, you can't demolish
them.
And that's the Mills building, which is over there, and the Department of the DHEC is basically taken over there. And the Babcock building, they're completely renovating into luxury townhouses that are going for about $500,000 a piece.
Can you imagine living there? Oh.
No. The hauntings and the spirits. I would never live there. So many thousands of people died there, and God only knows what happened there over.
Well, that's the thing, and they didn't die under good circumstances. Like, and so if you believe, like you and I believe, they're going to come back. They're going to make right the wrongs. And it wouldn't surprise me at all. Now, you want to do this again with another building, or what are you going to do from now on? I mean, I know this is new, but I mean, William, you can't stop with this one. You got to continue.
Oh, I know, and I've been to a lot of hospitals all over the place, doing the same thing. I just haven't really written about them. I've been all the way to West Virginia to do a photography tour of an old asylum there. I've been to the Central State Hospital in Georgia multiple times. I've been to both hospitals in North Carolina. I've been to both in Tennessee. I thought about doing another book from the viewpoint of the patients.
That's a good idea.
Hospital. The problem there is a lot of them don't want their real name used, and I don't want to have to use aliases.
Now you lead from one to another. Is the people that you talked to, were they glad to tell you things that went on there? Or some people would want to say, oh, no, don't mention my name, make a name up or whatever. I mean, were some of them like that?
As far as the staff, no, they were perfectly fine with me using their name. There is one patient story in there, and she was perfectly fine with me using her name as well. But I've interviewed probably 40 or people who were patients there. Not interviewed, but, you know, spoke to over the phone.
Sam talked with them or something. How did you find them, William?
And most of them don't want their real name used. I found a lot of them through Facebook advertising and going through the Department of Mental Health in Columbia. They hooked me up with a lot of contacts, especially the people who work there. They hooked me up with like the first chapter is about the hospital historian Woody Harris, and basically I'd go and interview some people, and then those people would hook me up with other people who work there.
Yeah. Oh, you need to talk to this one, and you need to talk to this one. Yeah.
Exactly.
I can see that happening.
Exactly. And once they saw my work and they saw that I was, you know, I wasn't trying to sensationalize anything or that I was trying to, you know, present the facts. Most people were more than willing to be interviewed. Because
awesome.
You know, they love their work. They love their work. And here's the thing. So many people worked there. So many people were patients there over the years. And you have this gigantic area of land in the middle of downtown Columbia. And just for centuries, everything was just so secret. It was almost like, you know, like an Alcatraz with fences around it. Everybody
right.
knew that there was a lot going on there, and that, you know, thousands of people were work had worked there or stayed there, but it was all just a big secret. Nobody from the outside got a glimpse of it. So a lot of people were interested in what happened there and, you know, the treatment that occurred there, the patients they were getting there. But yet so little was known about it. And that's why I wrote the book, to kind of, to reveal more of what went on there as far as mental health care treatment.
You've got a picture in here of curlers inside a beauty salon. That's a tray that's on wheels. I used to use that in the nursing home.
Oh, okay.
Well, because it was on wheels.
I would imagine that would look very familiar to you. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Because then you used it wasn't blow drying or anything like that. But most of the patients wanted their hair curly, so you used rollers. But that was the tray, mm-hmm. That I believe I brought it in. I think it was mine. I mean, you could get it at the beauty supply. But it was on wheels so that I could go to whatever patient I wanted, in that room that
sure.
I had. It was a good-sized room. There were quite a few hair dryers, and there were some shampoo bowls and things like that. And, that's exactly what it looked like.
And that's another thing that a lot of people don't know is all of these state hospital campuses were self-sustaining communities, which they were all built with the intention of patients never had to leave the campus.
Right.
They had their own barber shops. They had their own beauty parlors. They had their own cafeterias. Some even had their own slaughterhouses. They had their own medical facilities. They had everything. So, they were built as a self-sustaining community to where patients never had to go off the campus. Everything was
Then it went downhill because it just. It had to start with some people that were there because I'm sure there were horrors and mistreating because somebody would swing at you and you'd swing back at them. And of course, I think it just got bigger and bigger and bigger of a problem. And if you didn't have anybody like me walking the halls, things would go on and nobody would know the difference. They would not know because the patient's not going to tell you.
No. And even if the patient does complain,
you won't believe them anyhow.
How much credibility are people going to give them? I know. It's something else. It's a wild topic, and I found it very, very, very interesting.
Well, like I said, you cannot stop with just this place. You must continue on. You must. You must. This is amazing.
I should. You're right. And, so much of it, well, before I forget, the thing about South Carolina is we've always been a pretty government funds.
Yeah.
And because of that, the care at the South Carolina State Hospital, it suffered tremendously from a low budget. I think we were ranked either 48th or 49th in the nation as far as money in our Department of Mentally Ill, budget. And the guy in charge of the state hospital, his name was William S. Hall. He was constantly going to the state house and campaigning for more funds.
Trying to get
and
he more would even funds.
He would even take lawmakers inside the hospital
to let them see how bad it was because you didn't have the staff. You didn't have the right kind of things to take care of them. And,
He would show
they wouldn't
them,
want
would
to talk
them,
to me.
Yeah, he would show them some of the more deplorable places and states of the hospital, basically begging them for money. So he was always a wonderful guy and a wonderful – he started off as superintendent of the hospital and then became director of the Department of Mental Health. But he was always working to obtain more funds for the hospital. It's just we're a poor state and we never got them. So it being overcrowded and underfunded, that was just the nature of the beast back then. And
you can think about this, as far as getting help, like if you AIDS, not necessarily nurses, but AIDS, you'd have to take basically whatever was applying. I mean, you just have to hope that I would have hoped, that you did a good job. And then you're going to get some in there that are probably as bad as some of the patients, not mentally ill, but their demeanor. And you're probably like putting some monsters in there that just wanted to make some money. They didn't care. These people were sick anyhow. What's the difference? See, that's the problem, too.
Kind of like some prison guards, yeah.
You know, you have to, yeah, you really, it could have been set up much better. Any newbies coming in, you have somebody doing a surveillance on them, going with them. But it's pretty hard. It's difficult when you have a place that size. That's huge.
It is. And whenever somebody from the state or from the nation would come and, you know, come to check the place out or inspect it, they would usually get word beforehand and they would shuffle things around.
Yeah,
it
would straighten up.
The problem
right.
Didn't stand that. Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, I would have been hell on wheels there.
Oh, you would
any
have.
Place.
You would have.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I would have had them jumping through hoops. But I think, it was a different time. And, you know, I'm sure there were people like me that they really cared. But what they always thought, well, what can I do? I'm gonna lose the only job I have, like the nurses. Mm-hmm. But, gosh, that's just the post-traumatic stress from all that for them must have been horrific. And when they finally left, you have visions, because I did, of these people, and I didn't work in a place like that, but you have visions
right.
of these people that were, you know, and I'm so, you know, I just know I miss my calling, but look what I'm doing. I get to talk to people like you who are experiencing things.
Exactly. I don't think you missed your calling at all. I think you're doing exactly
yeah,
what
yeah,
I'm
telling
you,
your story because
do.
It's so important. It really is. Now, I'm going to write to you because I want to do an excerpt in the next month's magazine, and I'll put a picture
okay.
of the place and everything and
you.
A link to the show, and I'll send you a link to the show. And when we're done here, I'm going to send this off to Twitter, and people will get to view it and, you know, listen to it, rather, and I just think it's a wonderful story that you've told. And
well,
you have to promise
well, hope,
me you're going to
well,
continue. You have to do this, William.
I will, and I'm still writing, but I also, it's now. I teach freshman
Oh, yeah, I was
going to
ask you, now, what are you teaching and where do you teach?
I teach at Spartanburg Methodist College, and I teach freshman English.
Okay.
And I've been doing that for about 3 years. And actually, we go through some stories in this book as part of the curriculum, which is pretty cool. But they are so lucky. Yeah, well,
they are so lucky.
Thank you. They seem to enjoy the chapters we cover.
But you know me,
class.
I'd be in the first row raising my hand. What about this? What about that? But you
I'd
know,
love to have you,
have
you
to
as
ask
a student.
Questions.
Yeah, you would have made a great student, Natalie.
Yeah, I have this. He's got his doctorate. he's been on my show twice, and he always says,
uh-huh.
you know, because I didn't graduate from high school. But I went on to beauty school, and he said, you know, you don't have
right.
to go to school to be intelligent. And he told me, and he said, well, if you were in my class, what would you do? And I said, I'd be raising my hand, and I'd be in the first row.
Exactly.
I said, and you would have to answer my questions. But he said, you know, the thing of it is, you would have very good questions, where the other ones would sit behind you, and they would like, where did that come from? Why is she asking that?
Exactly.
But that's part of it. You make it interesting. And so, for you teaching in the curriculum about this, I think that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
To include that, oh, you got it firsthand. You know.
Well, I think they could learn a lot. They could learn a lot from it. And I'm not sure I'd want to have you in my class. You might be one of those students that ask questions I can't answer.
Could be. You know, my husband was a teacher. He taught science in middle school.
Right. Oh, okay.
And, yeah, but that was different. You know, that was all, you know, bugs and frogs and things like that.
But obviously, it's true. You don't have to have gone to college or have any certain education to be intelligent. You know, it's like that Bob Dylan line. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's true. And I've gained so much knowledge from people like yourself, and I'm so happy you wanted to do this. I really, really am.
It's my pleasure. And
look how fast the hour went. Actually, we went over the hour, but that's okay. I have 90 minutes. Candy, my gal that does the marketing and stuff and does my show page, she sets it up for 90 minutes because she knows. She just said the link to the show is posted on Facebook and you're tagged. And she said, thank you, William, for sharing your time and experiences with us. She does all of that for me.
Thanks to her.
Well, she's listening.
Absolutely.
She hears you. You can thank Candy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Candy really did a great job. She'll get the show page, and then she runs with it, William. I'll hear this ding, 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 ding on my phone because that means, that's Candy. My son said to me one day, what is all that? I said, it's just Candy posting. That's what she does. But it's great to have people like that.
Absolutely.
I'm going to send you an email now when it comes time to do something. I want to excerpt. Anytime you want, after that, anytime you want to write for the magazine, just let me know. I mean, goodness gracious, you're a world of information. And what you can do, too,
I'll
I just thought of this,
now.
So I'm giving you work to do, is you can tell how you see, how you saw something. Your take on going in and looking, I know it's in your book, but this would be firsthand from you. Think about things
mm-hmm.
that you can write. And this new stuff that you're doing, oh, yes, I'm going to be after you. You know that.
Okay.
Thank you for sending me the book.
I'll be happy to follow up on all of this. Oh, yeah.
Well,
I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for reading it.
Oh, I enjoyed it? Oh, yeah. Oh, you even wrote in it. He put here. What did he write? He said, for Natalie, I look forward to our interview. Enjoy the book. Oh, I will. I did. And, you know, it's the kind of book that you can go back and flip through, and you see a picture, and then you think about, I want to know what this is. What was this about? Why? And you have a lot
mm-hmm.
of a lot of pictures in there, William, lots of them.
Yeah, I was very lucky, and I have to thank my publisher, the History Press, or Arcadia Publishing, because they allowed me to put so many pictures in the middle part of the book. And I think those pictures are essential for giving the reader, a sense of time and place and a real feel of the place. You have to know what it was like.
I mean, you can see a movie, right, William? But a movie is not real. It's not an actual thing that like a stretcher or like the little beauty shop, if you want to call that a beauty shop, with the little tray
mm-hmm.
with the curlers and the little things and the stairs and all of that. No, this is real stuff. This is real. It's not make-believe. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm happy to do it, Natalie. I'm glad we had such a thorough discussion. I'm not sure if we covered everything, but hopefully we covered enough to keep people interested.
Well, we can always do another show, too. You know, if you think of a way you want to handle it or what you want to say, I'd be happy to do this again. This was wonderful. I mean, and we were nonstop.
Yep.
Of course, you know I asked so many questions. Yeah, like you said, I'd ask too many questions, probably.
Well,
Natalie,
like
put your hand down.
No, like I said, I could talk about the book for 2 weeks. So, I just hope everybody gets a chance to give it a read. I think most people who've read it really liked it. I've actually had some people who've read it multiple times actually. So I can't ask for a better compliment than that.
No, and it was a must to have pictures in it. Absolutely, they just
mm-hmm.
topped it off so people could see. Because you can imagine in your head, but you have to see. These are real photographs. This is not a play. This is not a joke, you know? Not a joke
at
all.
No, not at all. No, it's
well, you have an awesome day. What's left of it? Are you teaching today?
No, I teach Tuesday and Thursday, so I have to get to my lesson plan, and I have to grade about 60 quizzes. But,
okay, I'll let you get to your quizzes. I know what that's like. When I was married to my husband, he would take in the summertime.
Yeah.
He'd do his whole all of his lesson plans. He'd type them all out in the summertime. Can you imagine that?
Smart. Well, he's obviously smarter than me.
No. He loved the kids. He was a great teacher, and I'm sure you are. Keep telling them stories. Whenever you can infiltrate stuff, let them know.
I will.
Because it's telling them what the world is like. It's not looking through a nice, pretty glass with paints on it. It's not all like that. I mean, you know,
no.
This is real. Oh, I'm so happy. I just feel
this
so good.
This is real, and it's an essential part of history, both state and national, in my opinion. So.
Go back to your quizzes, and I'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure, and look for my email. And, you know, as I always in my show, you're going to love this. Believe in things you cannot see. They really are there.
Absolutely.
You like that?
I agree.
Yeah, they are. That's on one of my banners 100%. Now because I say it all the time, and you know, it's true. I mean, but you have to believe that. And you know, because you were at a place.
Do.
Where you felt it. And I was in Savannah. Savannah is, you know, it's just, I'm so happy my granddaughter's going to school there because a lot of the places, a lot of her classes are going to be in these old buildings. And it's very historical there. And
it used to be
the number one place for ghosts. I don't know if it still is or not. But, yeah. A lot of history there, too.
I didn't realize
Columbia had so much.
Charleston and New Orleans, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I love Savannah. I've been there. I've only been there a couple of times, but I've lived in Charleston before, and you know, it has quite a history of ghosts as well.
It sure does. The churches that are there are amazing.
And the old jail.
We could talk for hours, you and I. Okay, I'm gonna let you go. Go to your quizzes so you maintain your status as a teacher and you don't fall off the wagon, so to speak, that you're just going to be top drawer, and look for my email, and thank you so much. And everybody, the name of the book is The South Carolina State Hospital Stories from Bull Street, and it's
a beautiful story. Natalie, thank you once again, and I think you're very gifted at what you do, and I hope you keep up the good work, okay?
Oh, thank you. We'll talk again in email. Have a great day. Yep, and thank you, Candy. I know you've been here. Yeah, she loves us. Oh, yeah, I told her she would.
Thank you, Candy.
Okay, well, we always do, after I say my little believe in things you cannot see, they really are there, we play some music called Free to Love by Gabby Ray, and we have permission to do it because of Candy that knows her, and so we're going to play that to end the show. So you feel good. It's a feel good. It's kind of like it makes you move in your chair, sort of, kind of. And off we go. See you next week. We'll see what time will it be. It'll be 11 to 12. It's going to be 2 o'clock. 11 to 12, no, next week. 11 to 12 is my interview next week. So, okay, bye, William. Take care. Talk soon.
Bye. Take care of yourself. Thanks again, Natalie. Bye-bye.
I will. Bye-bye. Okay, let's play this.
If everyone could be who they were really meant to be, without limitations, discrimination, this world could show all its colors, so get the chip off the shoulder. Free to love.
Have a good week, everybody. See you next Wednesday. And remember, believe in things you cannot see. They really are there. Bye-bye.